This is an interview with John Pike, who is the managing director of WHRF. The date is the 13th of October, 1987, and we're talking in the boardroom, the WHRF building. I'd like you to start off with something about your background, your family, and your coming to the UW, anything you want to say about.
Well, having been born and raised here in Madison, I think, and going to high school at the old University High on the campus, it was not a very thoughtful but a natural decision just to stay where I was and continue going my undergraduate days here.
What was your father's occupation?
My father had died when I was very young, only 3 years old, and so my mother had come back to her home, which was here in Madison, and had gotten a master's in education and become a city school teacher. So and we in fact lived with my grandfather, who'd been in business here and by that time was retired. So that was a somewhat unusual childhood. But as far as any direct connection or even knowledge of WHRF, I'm afraid that awareness didn't creep in until after I was married, because I married Don Slichter's daughter, and he, by that time, was a very active member of the WHRF board, and of course his father had been one of the key members of the university at the time WHRF was organized, and certainly had a hand in its formation. So I heard a limited amount about WHRF during the 10 or 12 years that we were married before I came to join the organization.
How did you meet him?
When we were undergraduates here, both of us at the university.
And what did you major in?
I was an economics major, and at least at the graduate level, focused on the financial side, which took me across the street to the business school, and in that sense was kind of a split major. And after finishing my PhD, I taught in the business school down at University of Illinois in Champaign. And in fact, earlier than that, during these interruptions in graduate school, I had worked as my first financial job had been in the what was then the bond department of Northwestern Mutual, which happened strangely to be headed up by Don Slichter. And I guess that leads to the whole personal story, which may not really be on track here, but in any event, he hired me, and along with the course of events, I sort of resurrected my friendship with his daughter, which ended up with our decision to get married, at which point I told Don that I had a three-pronged announcement for him. One, that we were going to get married. Two, that I was quitting my job. And three, that we were going to go to London. At which point I went spent a year at the London School of Economics. But the message, of course, was that there was no possibility of my staying in that job and working for him. So we began that relationship very much aware of the problems of nepotism. And I hope, and I think truthfully, neither he nor I thought that was a factor in my decision here to come here to WHRF.
Had you thought of having a teaching career? You say you taught at the university.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That's what you expected.
The effort of finishing my PhD was clearly focused on teaching, and I did do that for 5 years, and gradually got restless in a way that I suppose is not too unusual for people who are in an academic pursuit that also has a direct outside possibility. In other words, I found the doing more interesting or challenging than the studying or talking or at least being on the sidelines. And I considered a number of other jobs, but places like banks tended to want you to be in what I viewed as ornamental positions. They wanted somebody with a PhD who could write yet one more economic newsletter of some kind, make comments about economic outlook, but not be really directly involved in the mainstream of their business. And I did not find that very appealing. So I therefore stayed on in teaching for a couple more years. And then, much as we have now, in the late 60s, there was a very strong financial market, stock market boom, if you will, and very large salaries paid to people who had been in the right place at the right time. And the investment board, with its civil service environment, was having a great deal of trouble keeping people, at least attracting the kind of people that they wanted to have around. And the then chairman of the State Investment Board, Stan Rui, had actually been one of the people I'd worked with on my own dissertation a few years before, and I knew him slightly. But anyway, he heard of my interest in a business job and called and asked if I'd be interested in talking to them about coming here to Madison to the investment board, and I was indeed interested. In fairly short order, we agreed, and I came up here in the fall of 1968. Started at the investment board, and a year later was made director of the investment board. And I really felt that I was a beneficiary of that very strong stock market, that a lot of the people that they really would like to have been able to hire were unavailable to them at the salaries they could pay. So they were forced to take a chance on a professor. And that gave me an opportunity to be involved in, well, virtually every kind of investment vehicle that was at least in existence at that time. It was excellent experience. The staff was small, that meant you really got involved. You didn't just hear a long line of experts come through and tell you what they'd just done. So it was an interesting and valuable interval, but as with a number of my successors, I felt no enthusiasm for the civil service structure and for the legislative mentality and the continuous really harassment that comes, because inevitably there are mistakes. You do make bad loans. If it's 1 in 100 or 3 in 100 or whatever it is, it's still therefore fair game for the newspapers and the legislators. They love to investigate and conduct postmortems, and you end up spending too much of your life worrying about that kind of thing and answering questions that I think the answers are obvious and straightforward, but they're always looking for some kind of malicious intent, some other suspicious motive. So that, anyway, in due course, I felt that I'd had enough experience and was prepared to move on and talk to a number of people about suggestions that they might have, and as luck would have it, one of the people I chose to talk to was Stan Rui, who at that time, it turned out, was, well, he was not then, but he was a key trustee of the Wharf, a member of the Wharf Board. And by that time, he had left the investment board. So he asked me whether I'd be interested in Wharf. I obviously was. A few weeks later, he arranged a meeting, two of us, with the then president of the Wharf Board named Hy Romnes, who was the chairman at American Telephone, we had a short, not particularly heavy or sophisticated meeting, and they offered me the job, which I accepted in short order, with one interesting proviso. I don't know how much personal stuff you want to give me. One interesting proviso. I asked them if this was in November. I asked them how long I could delay my arrival, because it was geared to the expected retirement of Ed Rosten, which was at that point a little over 2 years in the future. And they didn't think too much of delaying this very long, but I felt I had a commitment to the investment board for at least a couple months. And in any event, we finally settled on August 1st of the following year, about 10 months later, and that gave me a chance to take the sabbatical, which I had missed, having left Illinois when I did. We ended up moving our kids into a school near Lisbon, Portugal. Spent about 5 months, managed to go through the revolution over there. Had an interesting start, if you will, to the Wharf Jar. But in any event, I was hired to be Ed Rosten's successor. That was the intent from the beginning. Ed had been at Wharf for I think about 35 years, including a stint in the military during the Second World War. He was an accountant by training who drifted into the investment business, but he obviously had learned a great deal about the organization, had literally grown up with it, and he was my mentor, or the person that I looked to, both in that year and a half or so that we were both here, and then he continued to serve in a consulting relationship after he retired.
I find it kind of interesting that the two board members could decide to hire you. Do you think, have they consulted with others?
I'm sure they had consulted with others, but I think the only string on it was that there was a board meeting coming up in a few weeks, and I was invited to attend that board meeting with my wife. And exactly when the offer was made wasn't really clear at the time, and is even less clear now. But I think if somebody had taken strong exception our behavior or something during that board meeting, it might have been corrected, because as I remember it, I didn't tell the investment board about my decision until after this last review down at the Wharf meeting.
Mm-hmm. Well, did they hire you because of your experience in investing or your experience in managing?
I don't think there's any question that the emphasis at that time was strongly on the investment side. The record is clear that investments have come to be the dominant income source. But further, there was some feeling then that the royalty flow would diminish even further. The problems associated with federal funding, the ability to get title to inventions was just unsettled at that point, and I don't think anyone really was forecasting it, but I think the feeling was that it was possible that the royalty stream would dry up. Patent licensing could never be a major activity, and therefore they weren't looking for someone with that background. Related to that, it's probably worth mentioning that Rosten's longtime associate and at least technically boss was Ward Ross. And Ward had taken early retirement in either 1970 or 71, in large part because he felt the same way, that his background as a patent attorney and years of experience with the licensing effort were coming to an end, and that these legal issues involving the federal government's policies caused him to think that at least the Worf activities as he'd known them didn't make sense anymore, that it would come to be primarily an investment activity, and therefore he was moved to retire by 2 or 3 years earlier than normal.
And was this his choice, or did the board have some...
No, it was clearly his choice, and like Ed, he also stayed on for a while in a consulting role. But I think he was anxious to get to a warm climate, enjoy life a bit, and take it easy. And combined with this feeling about the direction things would take, it made it a fairly straightforward choice. And it turned out, of course, not to be that clear-cut. There were a number of things that happened along the way, but his dire forecasts happily turned out to be a bit off the mark. Patton's side is alive and well, but in terms of income and obviously on assets, it's the investment side that does and presumably will continue to dominate.
Will, how did you feel about being offered this job?
I found it attractive. Again, partly because of some of the problems I just mentioned about the investment board, and I'm just not cut out for the civil service. Again, having grown up here, my wife having long roots here, we were very happy to be able to stay in Madison. Our children were school age at that time, so we had good continuity. And they spent virtually their entire school years here in the city. All of those things were very appealing. As far as the job itself, I liked the fact that the investment activity represented the core, but that there were still other activities almost on the fringe, things that I could learn about. I was a total novice, for instance, about patent law or licensing. And even at that time, things like the coating laboratory, the Worf vitamin concentrate business, and the Institute, which had newly moved into the facility at Truax, all added some of that. And I guess everyone in Madison has some dim recollection of an association between Worf and Wisconsin Dells, the tourist business up there. And so there, again, things that just seemed to put a little extra flavor in the situation.
You must have thought, though, possibly of going off to New York and getting into the big time.
I guess I could even be more specific than that. In terms of financial and power elements, the biggest choice I ever had to make was suburban Los Angeles. And those issues were primarily family and personal. I just didn't feel that was an environment I wanted to be in. I didn't think it would be good for my family, and no one in my family who's ever visited, or in one case a daughter who's lived there for 8 years, has ever said they thought that they were shortchanged by not growing up out there.
So in other words, at that time you had the choice. You might have gone out.
Yes. Yeah, but the reason I answered it that way is that New York was out of the question to begin with, and I wasn't about to move to New York under any circumstances, and that was part of the problem, to find a job outside, well, if possible, outside one of the huge metropolitan areas.
Yes,
that's right. Well, one of the clear and easy problems to point to had nothing to do with any individual, but was just the circumstance of the timing. I came in the summer of 1974, which was the pit of the bear market, and the Wharf portfolio had been badly hurt by that bear market because it had been invested in the very kind of securities that caught the worst of it. So it was a lesson that everyone was learning and reeling from. And that did inevitably form some of the background that even today we draw on to probably be a little more conservative than they were then. The other thing that surprised me when I came here was that, quite unlike most organizations, a very large part of the responsibility on the investment side, and even some of the operating decisions, were being made by board members. There was a small investment committee that was remarkably active, and Ed Rosten had over the years built a very fine relationship with them, primarily with the longtime chairman of it, whose name was Ralph Johnson. And Ralph was a superb investment man and contributed immensely to the investment success here. I'd say he's one of the truly unsung heroes. We sit here in this room with oil paintings of people who've been elected president, including Stan Rui, who's obviously had a major role in my career. Yet there's no picture of Pete Johnson because Pete never had that role here, and yet he, in a very real sense, was kind of a co-manager of the Wharf investment account. By the time I came along, Ralph was retired. He was getting along in years, and certainly one of the issues was that the Wharf group as a whole was then already starting reach an age where you needed to worry about what kind of an organization was going to come in and follow them. And Ed's relationship with them was just not something that could be reproduced. It just wasn't done the way anybody else could or probably would want. So long standing, and frankly, because even as a busy partner in a Wall Street firm, Ralph would take full days out of his career to spend it working on Wharf. That's an unreasonable request to make of anybody, and certainly no one on our board is asked to do that kind of thing.
Well, now, Brittingham must have done that, certainly.
I think he did. And I think Ralph really followed in his footsteps. That's of course long before my day.
Yes.
The only difference I could point to is that Brittingham was primarily investing for himself or running his own business, whereas Ralph was a partner in a large brokerage firm called Smith Barney, presumably had to answer to his other partners. No question about it, and very generous in drawing on the other resources of Smith Barney.
And he had retired
he had retired, but he retained a relationship out there and continued to have an office and people that he worked with, so that there was some continuity. But as Ralph's energies diminished, it inevitably reduced our relationship.
So that when you came along, this center for investment decisions was breaking up.
Phasing down. Okay.
And that must have been a major thing for you to think about.
That's certainly correct. And they had had some younger people in helping Ed and Ralph Johnson in working on the investment portfolio, but it's my sense that they really never got a very good handle on things. Yes, some staff people were brought in. And there was some turnover there. These were tended to be young people in their 20s, early 30s, who were here for a few years and left. And I think part of the problem was that they really never had much of a voice in what was going on, and never really felt a part of the action. So clearly one of the things that I thought was appropriate, and which we did do, was that hired as our, called the title investment director, the man who had worked with me at the investment board and who had succeeded me in the job of executive director. And after, I suppose, a year and a half or 2 years in that more administrative role, he decided that he was not enamored with the civil service and the rest of the constraints of government employment, and he was quite happy to go back to his original function, which up there had been director of stock investments, and basically does that same role here yet today.
Hmm. Well, so you didn't think you could handle it all, is that all?
I saw my role after Ed retired as general overall management of the organization, but not being the expert in any one of the activities that we carry on.
So even though they got you because of your experience in investment, you that role wasn't your primary responsibility?
Well, that's correct, but for instance, I am a member of the investment committee. And I clearly have more of a role on the investment side than I do on the patent side. I suppose for no other reason, just because it's more familiar to me and more comfortable.
So an investment committee that was appointed replaced this long-standing one.
Again, it was evolution. The membership changed. Very hard to measure things like that because so much is dependent on the external environment. If the market goes badly, inevitably your portfolio does badly. It's just a question of how badly. And currently we've been enjoying a long extended bull market, and that has benefited us in the way that they enjoyed some great successes earlier. And the investment business has changed. I'm sure that the way Tom Brittingham functioned, and even Ralph Johnson in the earlier days, couldn't be carried on anymore. It's become much more institutionalized, much heavier volumes of trading, and even the sources of information have changed. Where at one time, I'm sure they depended on the personal knowledge of prominent, successful businessmen who served on the board and who knew from personal knowledge about developments that at least could have some financial implications. I think that's largely a thing of the past, and there is a much more standardized flow of investment information.
So the other members of the board don't have much to do with investments. Would that be fair to say?
That is fair to say, although the bylaws make it clear that all WORF members are alternate members of the investment committee. We're now in a pattern in which the investment committee meets 6 times a year. 3 of those meetings are at the time of the regular board meeting, and the non-investment committee members are invited to attend those meetings, and most of them do. There are three other interim meetings which they receive minutes after the fact, but are not invited to attend. So it's kind of a mixed bag. They make suggestions, and their responses vary with the individual circumstances. One thing that's different, too, is that the board is so much bigger. We now have 17 board members. As I understand it, back in the days, let's say of the 40s and 50s, it was unusual to get to 10. Seven, eight was the typical number. You can do things with a group that size that you can't do with 17.
That's one of my questions, is why that happened.
In 1974, when I came aboard, I was told that the group was getting elderly. They had quite literally just grandfathered themselves in, having a retirement age for only those who came later, but that they were preparing by adding their own replacements, and the board in effect was going to be doubled briefly while attrition took its natural course, and that the new members were going to come in, and I think the at least implicit assumption was that the number would then be allowed to melt back to some smaller figure, maybe 11 or 12, something like that. Although it's varied a bit, it's never gotten back down there. Some of the people who were bringing in their own replacements have seen the replacements come and go, and they themselves are still here with us. So it's hard to tell, but I think we're increasingly kind of building a tradition of having the number somewhere around at least 15. And of course, there is no clear answer as to what the right number is. But I'm sure we're at the upper end of.
Yes,
of,
I think so.
Yeah.
I've always understood a board much bigger than 11 or 12 or 13 would have to be unmanageable.
Well, it's not unusual in the corporate world. A lot of these people coming from big companies are used to having boards, even in the low 20s. So this doesn't seem terribly unruly to them. And it is true criterion that have been used have varied, and we have acquired board members from different parts of the country, and they inevitably have a less active role. I don't think there's any escaping it, particularly if they have active careers underway. When they retire, there's probably a little more interest in getting involved. Attendance varies considerably, but for example, the last meeting, everyone was here.
Yes, there must be a big fund company.
Yes, that's another thing that's impressed me, is that I think they've genuinely enjoyed themselves. And it's partly because they like each other. There has come to be a social dimension. It is quite common for the trustees to pay their wives' expenses just to have them here for a day plus an evening. And my wife usually tries to arrange some kind of an activity, but obviously there aren't a lot of galleries or shopping sprees or things that you might typically think women might want to do, and yet they keep coming. In the fall, we have a football game planned, and they rarely go. Out of the 17, probably two or three or four will take tickets, and the rest will not go to the game. So it's because it's a group that enjoys getting together.
Oh, you mean they're doing things together rather than?
Well, I'm thinking of things like the dinner. We always have a get-together with a cocktail hour and dinner. Some limited speech, but certainly no serious speaker. There used to be an attempt to make that into a business session with the wives segregated. They'd eat in a different room, and the president or chancellor would talk and in effect be making the grant request at that time. But for the last 10 years or so, that's been changed, and other than sort of a limited kind of a greeting and a few anecdotes about what's going on, no one makes any speeches, and the grant business occurs during the regular meeting.
Now, how did that come about?
That they discontinued? I can remember very clearly that it happened when Bill Beers was president, and I think it was mainly based on his corporate experience and that of his wife, who felt that this kind of environment made more sense, that the wives ought to be involved, that there ought to be a little more of a social aspect to this, and that everyone would enjoy it, that we could make sufficient room during the day meetings to take the business that had normally occurred at night. Typically, the chancellor and his wife, the dean of the graduate school and his wife, and occasionally some other, call a special guest, a faculty member, maybe an inventor. Hector DeLuca has been there. Heinrich Schnoes has been there. Occasionally, somebody who's one of the deans, maybe. Like Glenn Pound, when he retired, I remember, was one of them. Mrs. Steenbach has attended. It's that kind of a thing. Sometimes a guest, sometimes not.
Who decides who's going to be the guest? Do you?
It's usually circumstance. This past meeting, the guest was Donna Shalala. Really, because Bernie Cohen called me and said that she would be in town that weekend and that he was scheduled for this anyway, so she would have the time, and that'd be a good chance for her to meet the Wharf Board in an informal setting. And it happened that we went up to the Wisconsin Dells, had a bus to go up there, and was there for the trustees' first chance to see a piece of property that we bought a couple years ago, and it all worked out fine. She was able to participate, at least get to know a few of them. So there's no format. Somebody makes a suggestion.
I was wondering how the board felt about her. I mean, whether they discuss things like appointments and duties and chancellor.
Well, the chancellor is the key representative of the university as far as Wharf is concerned. The chancellor is the focal point of our effort, and therefore they're always concerned and interested as to who's going to be the trustee. They have had an excellent relationship with Ed Young and then with Irv Shane, and I'm sure will expect to have the same one with same kind of relationship with the new chancellor. Irv changed the rules somewhat, again, at his own initiative. We have the formal requirement that we followed has been to get a preliminary university grant proposal in the fall, usually September, and then a final one for action in May. That would apply to the fiscal year beginning the following July 1. Upon attending a meeting, Irv, for whatever reasons, decided that he wanted to be much more aggressive, and in effect attended almost all of the meetings, including the interim meeting, which there really was no grant request. He would typically make a at least commonly, he made some specific requests for equipment, special projects of some kind, starting some of the new institutes, research centers. So he frequently would have some business to discuss, but many times those were things that could have been done at a different meeting. There wasn't that pressing a matter. And he also took those opportunities to give a kind of state of the university talk and bring them up to date on what was going on. But yes, I think Walter's absolutely right. There were a number of people who felt that it got overdone. Nobody wanted to be rude. Nobody wanted to say that he wasn't welcome. But I think everyone would have felt more comfortable if he'd waited to be invited.
I don't suppose
I think everyone is quite firm in their belief that our contact is with the Chancellor. The funds here originated with inventions that were made on the Madison campus. When Worf started, the university really was Madison, and our allegiance is to Madison, not to the system. Kenneth Shaw and his wife were another one of those Friday evening guests the year he came. It was that a year ago. And everyone was pleased to meet him, to visit with them. They're certainly nice people, and that's all fine. But there would be a very serious question if there were ever any indication that the system wanted to use war funds for non-Madison activities.
Yes, that's all overdone with now. And O'Neill, did you have him when he started?
In the same way. And in there's an example of the sensitivities. In both cases, we deferred to Irv Shane. In other words, we said, this is a good idea, but you arrange it. And if you think this is a good meeting, or a year from now would be better, or whatever, you set it up. And then we accommodated his judgment. Very definitely.
You said something about board members appointing their own replacements. I'm interested in how they are chosen.
We have a nominating committee. I'm sorry, a membership committee. And that is their function, to choose new members. Membership suggestions come from a variety of sources.
Including Irv Shane,
including me, but most importantly, including the present board, the sitting board. And they have informal, unwritten standards, but and they vary. I mean, they come from a variety of backgrounds, but I suppose the standard thing is that they're all successful in the business area, business or law. But sometimes they're interested in geography, for example. They may want somebody, just to be precise, from the east or west coast. There's a feeling that it's easy to get too parochial. You don't want everybody from the Midwest. But on the other hand, there was a time, particularly early on, when we thought it was important to have some Midwestern or even Wisconsin people, because we wanted them for investment committee members. Sometimes it's the kind of background that someone brings. But curiously, one of the things that hasn't gelled, at least since Ralph Johnson's day, is an investment background as such. We feel it would be a conflict of interest and a very difficult situation if we were to, for instance, have a board member who manages investment funds, say in a big bank, in an insurance company, or even more clearly in an investment management firm that he owns or partly owns. he would be getting investment ideas from us that someone might think he was taking advantage of in his other activity. He would also be in the situation where he'd be asked to give us free investment advice, which he's selling as his life's work to others, and that would put him in a tough spot. So rather than try to get into those problems, we've just elected to avoid any of that kind of thing.
Has that always been the case, or was that only necessary once the investment was
changed? I think it's people have come to be more sensitive about it. In a way, Ralph Johnson represented this same kind of conflict of interest, and I'm sure back in his days, Tom Brittingham did. We see it as a little different with someone like, Don Slichter, before he became president of the insurance company, when I was working for him, for instance, was running an investment operation down there. But it was sufficiently different than Wharf's investments. I mean, they primarily bought bonds, not stocks, and they were of a very different sort. So I don't think that created any undue problems. Some of that same thing applied to Jim Lundberg, who came on much later and had been the investment head of the operation up at Wausau Insurance Company.
But you took them on.
Yes. Some of these board members have come on with, if you will, secondhand recommendations. No one really knew them very well personally. They would visit with them either in person or by phone, but they really relied on the corporate grapevine, that somebody was on a board with them, or there was some other connection. And that does not seem to have produced any particular problem. There may be a few, but by and large, they seem to meld into a group quite surprisingly well.
It must be looked upon the way being on the board of the university.
I think it is. I think. And that's one of the standards that they've clung to. They've really chosen people who are at the very top of the corporate pyramid, and I think that begets interest on the part of others who are similarly situated. And if someone is a president or board chairman, he enjoys associating with others, or at least former. Occupancy. No, there have been a couple cases where people have turned it down for a variety of reasons. I think the most common is that these are people with very heavy commitments, and they just don't want to take on anything more. We've had one case that comes to mind of a person that's turned out to be just an absolutely wonderful, fairly recent trustee, is Jim Mathis. He was vice president in charge of research and development at Exxon. He turned us down when he was in the midst of that career, but said it was because of the stress of his job at the time, that he didn't know how long he'd be staying in that job, and that he'd like to be reconsidered if that were possible. It turned out that he took early retirement at about age 58, I think, and did come on board, and has just been excellent.
Awesome. In what way?
Well, he has a PhD in chemical engineering, and a lot of practical experience in the industrial world at bringing things to market, if you will, and that's a side of our backgrounds here that is a little weak. So he's very helpful and knowledgeable about the new technology that's coming in through the patent licensing side. And we find him very helpful there. And interestingly, that also feeds back into the investment side. He has had technically based investment insights that turned out to be very good. I think that's a good example of where this board really does function well. If we've got sufficient breadth of experience, I shouldn't have said if, I think we do have sufficient breadth of experience that there's usually somebody that's had some exposure to things that, that come along. They may not always be right on the mark, and they may not even always be helpful. I mean, it may be a blind alley of some kind, but usually there's something that that they've encountered that can help us at least add to what knowledge we have.
Does it happen very often that you call a board member just in the middle of the week to discuss something?
Not very often, but still from time to time. I would say in the investment area, it's the most common, but in licensing or even in some of the separate corporations. For instance, we haven't even really mentioned it, but up at the Dells, there is a trustee whose background is in real estate and is called the liaison trustee. And he, even though for legal reasons, he can't function as a board member of the corporation up there, we consider him. And so if some issue, I mean of the Dells Bolt Company board.
He is on this board.
Yes. His name is Bob Draper. The problem is that the Dells Bolt Company owns a liquor license. And the state law forbids any director of a company with a liquor license to be a non-resident. So Bob can't serve as a director of this organization, but as I say, it has no practical. And I don't remember when I last called him, but when there's something up there, usually related to an investment or a real estate transaction of some kind, I'll call Bob and talk with him about it.
It occurred to me to think that before the UW closed down on it, that was...
It occurred to me that the board would have less choice of members from around the country because since the 1960s or so, there are far fewer students from outside of Wisconsin at the university. Is that the case or not, or hasn't it affected you yet?
If that's the case in terms of their origins, I doubt that it's the case where they end up.
Well, that's true.
So we're likely to have people working outside Wisconsin. I have only heard fringes of this conversation, but it's my recollection that there have been concerns from time to time about cliques forming within the board, some of them based on location. I know there was a concern about some Easterners who got together and felt they were being excluded by the Midwesterners or the people specifically in Wisconsin, and in turn formed a little Eastern group of their own, but I really don't think that occurs today.
That was before your time.
It was before my time, or I got in just on the edges, the declining edge of that.
But you didn't take any positive steps to that?
Yes, there were some positive steps taken. One example I can think of is that they made an effort to include Easterners in committees. Specifically, a chairman of the investment committee was named. It made things inconvenient. We would have to go for a day meeting to Philadelphia. But people were willing to put up with that inconvenience and expense to make sure that as chairman he was fully involved, chaired the meeting, and that it was relatively easy on him. So they did do some of that. I think also another response was to make Sam Leonard the membership chairman for quite a while. Yes, and living in Delaware. Contrary to what people outside the organization might think or expect, almost none at all. Most of us, and I very much include myself, knew Catherine before she was made a board member. Everyone was very much aware of her accomplishments and abilities, and she fit the book in terms of what people wanted in a wharf trustee. And the fact that she was a woman just was irrelevant. It didn't really matter. The only question was her previous position as an adjunct professor in the business school in Milwaukee. That made her unavailable to Wharf. That was not the kind of connection that we